It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Well, good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the 105th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian, Can Technology Help the World, is a website, www.westchesterguardian.com. This is my 179th column in the Grid Disruption series. There are also columns by Lee Hamilton, ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, and critic John Simon. I hope you read the columns and enjoy them, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll also find links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. I'm excited about the upcoming series of guests on this show, a computer scientist and author Peter Denning, Pulitzer Prize winner journalist Hedrick Smith, saloon owner and philanthropist Peter Walsh, and a panel of folks who have spent significant time in Latin America. I hope the audience for this show will catch up with the upcoming one as well. Then now to this show, the 105th in the series. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. But I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guests. My guest tonight is novelist and screenwriter Frank Hicking. I first met Frank at the meeting of the Narrowbacks, an interesting group that also was responsible for me meeting Edmund Fitzgerald, I'm the attorney and the guest on my 99th show. We'll talk a little about the Narrowbacks as the show goes on. Frank has a very interesting background, which was covered in depth on his first visit to his microphone the last October. All previous shows, as I mentioned before, are available under the radio tab at my website, www.johnmack13.com. The brief review, which Frank can correct or update in a minute, after the sickly childhood and the not really outstanding high school career, Frank became the traveler and spent 2 years in Europe living out of a cave in Spain. While traveling in Europe, it became evident to Frank that he had both a gift for languages and an ability to listen and retain information. Upon his return to the United States, Frank embarked on a career that included work as a private investigator in both the U.S. and Southeast Asia, where he added more languages to his repertoire, tours as an investigator to two district attorney's offices, Queens and Manhattan. The Manhattan DA's office at the time was the most respected in the country, and his time as a police officer in both Savannah and Los Angeles, where he served under present NYPD Commissioner Bill Bratton. Along the way, he was a reporter and enhanced his academic resume by obtaining both a bachelor and a master's degree. Then after that, he became a mystery writer and has a brand new book to discuss tonight. Good evening, Frank. Welcome to the show. How do I do?
Yeah, I think you did very well. Thank you, John. 105th. This is an honor. I'm honored. Thank you.
In my introduction, I mentioned the Narrowbacks, where you and I first met. I believe you've been the member longer than I have. Please describe the group and tell the audience what brought you to it.
I would say that you came in probably before I did. It's a group of predominantly Irish-American, but other peoples who get together, trade stories, sing songs. The songs are ballads, actually. They go on for minutes of beautiful narrative stories from other countries. and have a lunch every Thursday, last Thursday of every month.
Third Thursday.
Yonkers. Third, right. See, I wanted not to miss them. And the stories of the people there are extraordinary to me and how what they've done with their lives.
The first time that I was there, I saw one of your books. So that was either your first meeting or it was but you had been there slightly before me.
I think so.
I had Ed Fitzgerald on the 99 show, and I got him to sing. I normally, as you know, read one of my poems, either old or new, at the luncheon. And since I got him to sing on the radio, he's come to force me to sing at a subsequent meeting. And I have the worst singing voice in the United States, so that should be interesting. Yeah, the Narrowbox is I got into it because this the younger brother of the friend of mine was killed in Vietnam, and the first meeting that I was to, they changed the name of the group from just the Narrowbox to the Narrowbox private first class Thomas Minogue chapter. He's the younger brother of Kevin, who is my contemporary, and Jack Minogue, who's the regular attendee of the meetings. And there has been an effort to get him the Congressional Medal of Honor. He has the Distinguished Service Cross, and as the story goes, he was nominated for the Congressional Medal, and they went all the way up to the Joint Chiefs, where it was knocked down to the DFC because there had already been two recent Congressional Medal of Honor winners and his battalions. I don't know if that's the only reason, but it gives hope to the people. And there's one fellow who's been who's been canvassing congressmen for the last 2 years trying to get the medal up. I don't know any more about that. Do you, Frank?
No, I don't. And it's a very uplifting group, not just the dark side of war and suffering, but, as I said, very cheerful, very happy songs that I'm amazed people keep in their memories, going on and on and on, not just about Ireland, but from other places too. It's a group of balladeers and storytellers.
There's one fellow who actually sings a song in Gaelic, and he's a fellow who was something in the military, but he went to Vanderbilt, and he became ill, and he wound up doing the year at Iona. And mm-hmm. during that time, he was he was involved with the Gaelic Society, and this brother Charles Quinn, who was the moderator, who was the later Grand Marshal in this St. Patrick's Day parade, told him to come over to his house one Saturday. He showed up, thinking he was going to be taught something, and Brother Quinn had him out in the garden pulling weeds while he was singing the song for him. He said all the young students in Ireland know this song, and he wouldn't let him stop pulling weeds till he memorized it. So 60 years later, he knows it well enough to sing at the Narrowbox.
It's a beautiful song, the soldier song, I think. And I mentioned it to my brother-in-law, and he burst into the same song, also in Gaelic. So it's still a vibrant life going along like that. It's a beautiful song.
When he was in the Gaelic Society, Hugh O'Rourke, who's a former police captain, he was the president of the society. Then mm-hmm. Hugh gave a terrific talk, perhaps 6 months ago on the Irish Americans in the Bronx. And an interesting thing, since you're into history, that you probably knew, that in the 1890s there was something like 60,000 residents of the Bronx, and by 1910 there was 1.5 million or something, and it was all because the subway reached the Bronx,
right.
And all these people moved in. And one of the points that he made was the Irish always thought that the Bronx was an Irish borough, And the Jews always thought it was a Jewish borough, and they were both right because they didn't hang out together, and all of mm-hmm. their friends were of their own of their own groups, and that was all they knew. But I thought that was fairly interesting.
I do so, too. I agree with you on that. It's a fascinating city, all five boroughs.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's interesting that Staten Island has always been unique. It's really the only solid Republican borough. It's just different from the other four boroughs. So, before getting into the new book, please to give us an overview of the whole series for the people who may not have been here before or familiar with it.
Of course. My protagonist hero is Max Royster, a native New Yorker, an eclectic man describing himself as a boulevardier, a raconteur, and a student of the cocktail. He's a wisecracking guy who spent only 2 years in the New York City Police Department before being thrown out for mental illness, and has no pension and very little cash coming in. Nevertheless, he gets himself involved in mysteries and crime events in the city using unorthodox methods to solve them. And what also makes him unique is the theme of ballroom dancing runs through the series of the books. And Max is an enthusiastic ballroom dancer. And very few crime novels have that anymore, or ever had it. And I try to make the books as lighthearted and as amusing as possible while still dealing with serious topics such as racism and murder along those lines. They're very New York series, but people across the country like them.
Your experience as both a private investigator and police officer obviously provides background for the entire series. I know that you had experience writing for to pay as a reporter, but what led you from the investigating world to becoming a novelist?
I was a novelist really from the age of 12. I started writing. I realized I could scribble things down in notebooks. I found a copy of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine in a garbage can. And one story in particular made me say, I could be a writer, or I could try to be a writer. I want to be a writer. And I took that home with me, the copy of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, and read it, devoured it cover to cover, and started writing just from finding that in the garbage can.
I remember the night that I got a pencil on the owner of the mysterious bookshop and a writer, and you were on. You called in that night, but another person that called in, Phyllis Bonner, her ex-father-in-law, was one half of the Ellery Queen team. There were two cousins. There were two cousins who communicated.
Frederick
really,
and Manfred B. Lee. Lee, yeah.
Right, really only by mail. They disliked each other strongly if for a while and didn't get along. And I thought that was fascinating that they were able to keep their business relationship after their personal relationship had deteriorated.
I agree. I didn't know that. That's funny.
Your hero Max, as you mentioned, is the failed police officer who in some way redeems himself, at least to himself, by solving cases. Have you met people like this? That's A, and then B, do any of his cases come close to cases that you actually worked on, either as a PI or as a cop?
Max was a policeman only at the age of 42. He had done a lot of things before that. He'd been a chef in Hong Kong, a reporter in New Mexico, fought boxing in old Mexico, traveled around the world as a merchant seaman, and never planned to be a policeman, and had to sue the New York City Police Department to get on the job at the age of 42, and, as I said, was thrown off after just 2 years. I didn't want to make him a superhero. I didn't want to make him one of these people who never works out, eats and drinks enormously, but is in great physical shape. I want him to be very realistic, I want him to be a man who's always outnumbered, always outgunned, and doing his best to help humanity with very few resources. So he reminds me of a lot of people I knew, and is based on a partner of mine that died while we were working together, and we were working on a serial killer case at that time, and it occurred he died of natural causes, and this came full bloom into the character of Max Royster. That's the first book of the series entitled The Gypsy Twist.
I see we have an early caller from the 917 area code. Let me bring in a caller. Hello, caller. Who are you? From 917 area code? I guess not.
Could be a telemarketer, John. They're everywhere.
No. This is a person who called in from the 917 area code.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm here. Do you mean me?
Yes, I mean you.
Do you recognize this voice?
No.
How about we share the same birthday?
Yes, okay.
And we were both born in Brooklyn.
And now it's starting to come back to me.
Right. I'm in Coney Island. Oh, this is Frank's brother, sister, sorry, McGee Hickey. I'm here at Coney Island for a gathering of the Warriors movie, and I wondered if you ever watched the Warriors movie.
I started to watch 10 minutes of it, but I was working gangs in the LAPD at the time, and it was too depressing.
Yeah, I thought that. As I was watching the movie today, I thought this would be something my brother would know so much about, and it would probably hit too close to home.
Turn away from.
For the audience.
So yes, I thought I was just listening to the show. I didn't know I was going to be called upon to speak. I just love listening to my brother talk about the character of Max Royster.
For the audience, McGee Hickey is a well-recognized redhead on the street reporter for WPIX after the long career with Channel 2 in New York. She's now on Channel 11, and she's, in my mind, the best street reporter in New York City.
There are many, many, many better street reporters than me, but I thank you for the compliment, but no.
I think
my brother would say that I was the best street reporter.
So one who I always gave credit to was police reporter was Chris Borg, and I thought he was wonderful on Channel 2 News for years.
Yes, well, he was a former police officer.
I know that.
So he really knew a lot about crime, just like my brother knows so much more about so many stories that I cover, and he never reveals any information to me.
Well, your brother said earlier, and some of the stuff he sent me, was that he was the sickly child, and he was not real attentive in school until he graduated from high school. What do you remember about him? Do you remember that about him as a child?
Yes, all of that is true. Frank was the most interesting brother, member of family we could have imagined. He was always interested in police work at a very young age, and he used to quiz me on different stories and different crimes. I remember, Frank, remember the book you had, an FBI book? And you would ask me questions about different cases that you were telling me about. This is going back to when you were maybe 8 and I'm 6. We're in Pound Ridge, New York. You're quizzing me about a case where a man took out a lot of life insurance on his mother and then put his mother on a plane. Right, Frank? You want to tell me about that one?
Yes, we teased our mother about that. That was a true case. Yes, that does sound like me. And you're right, John. I was a terrible student until I got into criminal justice.
You were a terrible what?
Student.
Well, you were actually the best type of student in that you were curious about everything. You just didn't like to sit in the classroom and study hard. You were curious about the world. Frank was always a great reader. I can remember when he'd be walking our boxer dog, he'd be leaning against a lamppost reading a paperback. Remember how many paperbacks you had? When you would take a bath, you would just sit in the bathtub reading nonstop. And when you weren't reading, you were drawing pictures of men with guns and creating whole scenarios. The person you see today is the person he was from my earliest memory. Frank has always been so interested in crime and law enforcement. He's also one of the most ethical people, if not the most ethical person I know. He's a great believer in right and wrong, and the kindest person, the most generous person, always there fighting for the underdog. Sounds like I'm writing your eulogy. He's very much alive.
Not so
and
fast.
In the drawing and the reading, to remind me of how I envisioned Max Allen Collins, who was as you know, had graphic novels and comics before he was well known for his books. I was like that. I did extremely well in grammar school and in the early high school, and then I started reading what I wanted to read, and I never had the statuousness for French. It just wasn't on my agenda. I was the same way really through college. I coasted through there. It was only when I hit technology that I turned back into a very good student. Now, I know, as I said, I was terrible in French, and I know that you've got this amazing ability to pick up languages. Did you know you had that in school, or was it only when you hit Europe that you began to pick up the foreign languages?
Really only when I hit Europe. As I said before, I was a terrible student and very bad at the structure and did not know anything really about foreign languages. When I first got to Paris, John, I was looking for a hippie house, and everybody told me tout droit, which I understood just meant take every right turn. I didn't know that that was a French idiom for straight ahead. So I spent my first night in Paris taking every right turn until I had literally walked from Place de l'Étoile to the eastern edge of the city by showing these people this piece of paper and listening to them say tout droit. I said, oh, take another right turn. So that was my command of foreign languages when I first got overseas. But you have to develop and you have to adapt, or else I'd still be walking around trying to find that place. I found
McGee,
it at sunrise.
McGee, did you recognize him when he returned from his two-year exodus?
he's had a lot of exoduses. Which one is this, when you were 2 years in Europe?
In France.
Yes.
Yeah, starting in France.
Yes. Well,
yeah.
I actually saw him in France. My mother sent me on a mission. She was using me as bait. We didn't know where Frank was. So I was sent over, and I saw Frank in France. Frank is such an amazing linguist. I don't know if he's said how many languages he speaks. I mean, he can get into any New York City taxi and start talking to the driver in any language. Just amazing. And what are you, Mandarin and Cantonese you're fluent in? I know you always poo-poo it that you're not that good.
Equally bad in both.
But he really is. But it was interesting. All those years of French classes didn't kick in. It wasn't until you were in foreign countries, I think. He's always had a love of everything foreign. When we were growing up, he was always interested in the most far removed from his immediate world. Wouldn't you say that's true, Frank?
Yes. When we lived in Breezy Point, I was very young and nearsighted. I thought we were in France. Nobody cleared it up to me because we could look across the water and see the Empire State Building. I thought we were in France. It shows what I knew. They didn't know how nearsighted I really was and maybe how dull. But I was always interested in travel. And I still learn languages, not necessarily the traditional way, but by getting into stores and into conversations with people who speak it and trying to learn it on the fly.
Then, Frank, was McGee the better student than you were, as you remember?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It seemed like everybody in the world was a better student than I. But
well,
McGee especially.
I think you were probably a very good English student.
No.
You just always had to have a teacher that understood the way your brain worked. You take information in and it just stays in there forever. I think, like, what I do in TV news, you would never want to do because it can be so superficial. Frank really gets into the nitty-gritty. He really pays attention to detail. You know, as I get older, I start to look at, you know, the way people learn and the way they live their lives and what interests them. And I can go from one story to the next, and my brother will say, oh, remember that murder you did a story on a month ago? I have no recollection of that. But Frank will know more about it than I did as a reporter, just because he really pays attention to detail. Yeah, I was a better student in a very superficial way. I was always a good student, and that's what makes me good in TV news. A quick study doesn't mean I'm a deep study at all. It's probably the exact opposite.
Frank will remember this story, but there's a fellow in the Narrowbacks who was the youngest police officer, and he was involved on the edges of one of the weirdest cases they ever heard that involved some murder, eventually cutting the face off a woman and getting across the Canadian border wearing her face, driving her car, and we just happened to mention it. And Frank knew more about who the players were even than this cop remembered. And the cop said to me, he said, this guy knows more about the case than I did. So you do retain these things, as McGee said. I remember.
And ask him about cabaret singing. How many songs does he have in his head? How many songs do you have, Frank, where you know the lyrics of every single song?
You mentioned that as if I'm turning into a lounge lizard. I just think songs are wonderful, and I try to remember them whenever they come up, and I work at learning the lyrics. I think music is such a treasure, and so many people take it for granted. But I'm always singing. When I was a policeman in Los Angeles, I used to sing together with my clients when we were riding to jail together. Because jail is difficult, and you need some music to lighten the moments.
I have a musical heart and the worst singing voice in the world. In my local parish dances, I used to always be singing. If I was holding some young lady close, I'd be singing in her ear. And if she came back, she really had to like me.
the acid test.
What was that case that I'm referring to
that
Frank?
That was a Westchester County troop officer who was killed by a man named Alex Mengele, who, on a traffic stop, I believe 1982 or so, and Mengele then killed a woman named Beverly Capone, scalped her, and tried to get into the Canadian across to the Canadian border wearing her hair.
He was spotted by the Canadian cop who detained him, and some New York State police officers went up to pick him up. And on the way back, and for some reason, the way they do this, and this doesn't make sense to me, Frank, it makes sense to you. They had one of the troopers driving, and the other trooper in the back seat with this guy handcuffed. And all of a sudden, the guy driving hears something going on in the back seat, and he turns around, and Mengele has his teeth in the other guy's throat, and he's going for his gun. So the cop in the front stops the car, shoots Mengele, kills him, and then it was some investigation because immediately people said, "Well, they executed him," and the medical examiner was able to show that his teeth were almost to this cop's jugular. Now, why do they do it like that? Why don't they just have him chained in the back by himself and two guys in the front?
Standard police procedure is one person in the back to observe.
But obviously, in this case, he almost got killed with standard police procedure.
Yeah, I know. And that's the problem with it. It was more than 30 years ago. Things are safer now. They think about these things more often. I have been bitten while the client was handcuffed and kicked below the belt by the same client. And I had an enormous black and blue, rather blue, bruise on my arm. It stayed for months. The sergeants used to tell me to take off that tattoo. They didn't realize it was a bruise. And people can be very dangerous when handcuffed and fighting. And Mengele was certainly a very dangerous person.
But what's the reason for doing that rather than have two cops in the front seat and the guy riding shotgun turned around looking at the alleged perpetrator?
I'm really not sure at this point. As I said, that was a long time ago, and tactics have evolved and gotten much better than they would than they were back then.
McGee, you mentioned being dispatched to France to check on your brother. Did members of the family have this great worry while he's traveling around and he's the cop in different places and a PI in Thailand? How did your family handle?
My mother lit every candle in church every day. My mother made a vow to go to Mass every day for the rest of her life if Frank was found alive. I forget at what age, was that 18 or 19 or 20, where when he was in Europe and not in constant touch. And my mother was always making promises with God, if he's found, I will do this or that. And then when I was a TV reporter, when I was first starting out in New York, I would be on TV and I'd say, you know, a police officer has been shot and we're waiting for the identity, we're waiting for the family to be notified. My mother would always just assume that she was about to get the phone call. I mean, she just was a warrior. She's not with us anymore. And Frank was so amazing with both of our parents in their last years, just being such a devoted caregiver to them as well as son. But my mother was really worried about Frank, I think, every day of Frank's life because of his law enforcement career and his desire to travel.
I know
Bear,
what
would
that
you
is.
Say, Frank?
She would have been worried about something else if I had never come along. She was very good at it, but a very wonderful person.
I know what that's like. I grew up in the cop household. My father was NYPD.
Right.
My grandfather,
yeah.
My godfather, and people that are, you know, I remember my mother. He'd go out in the suit in the morning, and she'd take a whisk broom and she'd brush off his dark suit, and then he'd go off to work. And I knew even as a young child that she was worried about him. You know, it's just part of a cop's household.
I think because I had leukemia as a child or some disease that was very serious, I think Mom got into the worrying mode about me and never really got out of it. I think she was worried about one thing or another. And both she and I knew I had no physical toughness or mental toughness when I first started as a private eye. And I knew I was in way over my head. So I think the worrying and the going to church was just a lifetime pattern with her. I try not to make her worry as much. I try to reassure her all the time.
Oh yeah, but she was just a worrier. But she was always so proud of you, too, and all your work. And, you know, she'd say, you know, he's the kindest person. She goes, he just helps people. The side of my brother that maybe people don't know as the writer. He's also, when he was, Frank, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you were living in Savannah, Georgia, as a police officer, you were living in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. And you said that most of the children there had not seen a kind white police officer playing with them on the street. So you felt that was part of your job, to be a role model to them and to show them that white police officers can be their friends and can play with them. Is that true? Is my memory correct?
Your memory is good. John, in Savannah, we had no police locker room. You went and you came in your uniform, in your private car. And there was also no privacy in Savannah. So I happened to be living in the neighborhood, and the children were all convinced that I was put down on the earth just to amuse them. I mean, that was my sole purpose in life. And we got along very well. But being that there were no locker rooms, as I said, you went and you came in uniform, and I worked and lived on the same beat, which is a very high crime area. So naturally, and I had a heavy bag for boxing in my backyard. And they all, even the girls, would love to come and hit the bag. Heavy boxing bags are intoxicating for everybody. So we did an early version of community policing before it really became a catchphrase. And it seemed to work very well.
That's wonderful. I spent very, very limited time in Savannah. We used to have a place in Hilton Head. And it's a beautiful city, but I wondered about the racial mix. I was there in the 80s, and I don't know what it was like then, the actual community. Now, I was there traveling around. I went to a basketball game and things like that.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful city with a very high murder rate when I was there, 90 to 94. Lovely city, and the just felt so much compassion for the people who were trapped by the crack gangs and by the domestic violence there. Very dangerous.
I was a little turned off by their claim they were the second largest St. Patrick's Day parade in the city, and they had it down the Riverwalk, and they have green beer, and it was almost like the old New York that I grew up in. And the kid, they were encouraging you to get drunk and stupid on St. Patrick's Day,
yes.
As though that's what the Irish did.
There was a crazy celebration every year in Savannah, and everybody in Savannah would tell you that they didn't drink. But nevertheless, the beer was green, and the river was green, and the liquor flowed everywhere. It was chaotic.
I had a funny experience there. I was in. There was a strange smell in the area than Hilton had, and I was in the hot tub at this place we had. And I said, "What's that smell?" And the woman said, "Oh, it's a paper plant." So I went upstairs. I told my wife. There's a paper plant growing in the area. I thought she was talking about it like it was a eucalyptus plant. And it turned out it was a real paper plant in Savannah. So
yes.
Strange smell. McGee, you mentioned you're 2 years older, but you have the same birthday?
I'm actually 2 years younger. And
oh, 2 years younger,
right? That's all right.
And
we have the same birthday, 2 years apart. And our sister has a birthday 6 days earlier. So there was this one week in June that my parents really had a lot of birthday parties.
They must have gone on vacation sometime every year, I guess, before you were born.
It was right around their wedding anniversary. They got married in August 18th, and my older sister was born June 6th. So I remember as a young girl doing the math and thinking, oh, okay, that's all fine.
Were there
confines? It should have been the way it should be.
Were there three of you in the family?
Oh, and no, and there's a fourth. I have a little sister too. So I have an older sister, and then my brother, and I'm a middle of the daughters, and then we have a little sister who's a former ballet dancer and quite an interesting person too. I'm very proud of my siblings. They're all interesting people, but Frank the most.
So three girls than you, Frank, huh?
Yes, and our mother did not go on vacation, John. She was a working actress a lot of the time. She was in more than 200 productions, I think.
Oh wow.
If I'm wrong, McGee. Over the years,
wow.
It was 200 or so. But there was always a play.
There was always a play, and there was always something to do for her children and then her grandchildren. She was always working in some way.
Now, were you the only one that was sickly, Frank? Was everyone else? Or did
everybody
anyone
else
have it?
Everybody else seemed very healthy to me. Yes.
Oh, okay.
And you're very healthy now. You turned a corner pretty early
on.
I
did. Mom always took credit for praying me into good health.
Maybe it worked.
She brought me to a cloistered convent, and from what she told through family lore, that saved my life when my life was despaired of. So she was a daily communicant and very devout. And as McGee said, very, very giving and very generous.
Yes, there was a Carmelite convent in Brooklyn that she and my grandfather, her father, would go to all the time. And I went by it the other day. I believe it's the one on Klassen Avenue in Brooklyn. And I'm like, oh, that's the one. Do you know the one, Frank? Have you seen it?
Yes, I do. You're right. It's on Klassen.
It's interesting. A young lady that I have been interested in high school, went into the Carmelites, and her parents only see her either two or three times a year through a screen. She had no connection with anyone else, and she eventually came out, but another girl stayed in the Carmelites, and now she's in what they call an open convent out in Reno, Nevada, and she plays in community softball leagues, and they don't dressed like nuns anymore. It seems like the Carmelites have changed dramatically from a cloistered outfit to an ordinary nun's outfit. Do you know anything about that?
I remember going to the convent when I was very sick and very young, and we couldn't see the people. We couldn't see the sisters at all. They were there was a wood wall between us with a panel you could give mass cards back and forth to. but you couldn't see them. And I was terrified of who these invisible women were and what they must have done, the horrible things they must have done so that we couldn't see them. My mother explained to me they were very good and holy people, but that didn't stop me. I was still terrified. I was overdosing on the Twilight Zone then. I wasn't going to relax in those circumstances. I remember going to that convent all the time.
Yes, our grandfather, Pappy, had a nun that he would go to speak to regularly at that convent, and he never saw her face until she died. And then our grandfather was called to the convent to finally see her. So he was able to see her in death, not in life.
Wow. Is this the grandfather that was involved with Ebbets Field, or was that the great-grandfather, Frank?
That would have been great, because Ebbets Field was built in 1913.
Okay.
Right. This is the grandfather on our mother's side.
Okay.
Who we knew well. We didn't know the great grandfathers.
McGee, do you also do writing of your own in addition to television work?
No. Every now and then, friends of mine will say you should write your story, and then I realize everyone thinks they have a story to write, and not everyone does. Frank has many stories to write. I'm a musician in my spare time. I'm playing the flute a lot these days. I'm giving a recital next Sunday. Frank has been good to hear me when I play the flute and when I sing. I put the flute down. I wasn't serious for about 30 years. I played in high school and college. And that's what I was doing in France when my parents sent me to find Frank somewhere in Paris. But now I'm back to trying to practice an hour and a half to 2 hours a day, which is tough when I'm also checking the emails about a murder I could be on, you know, and I'm trying to see if I can get my C sharps in tune. But what I want to do for the next 3 decades is really work on flute, see if I can finally get somewhere. I've been playing the same Bach flute sonata in E flat major for 40 years, and I still don't have it right.
To write about the writing, the writer is someone who actually writes. Stephen King always points out that a writer must read a lot, but you can't call yourself a writer if you don't write and get something out the door. If you don't do that, you're a wannabe, not a writer. Now, Frank, you've gotten the whole bunch of catalogs out the door. You mentioned before when you're off the air that you're always taking notes, you're always thinking. But what tells you when it's time for a new book? Does the story come to mind, or do you just know it's time?
If you write every day, as I try to, it's like jogging every day. You get out, you put on your sneakers, and you do it. You don't think very much about whether I'm going to run today. And to me, writing is very important. I admire writers. I grew up admiring them. I'm reminded of the quote by Raoul Whitfield, who was a Pulp Fiction writer, lived too short a life. He said, "I was born." The truth is, he said, "I was born to be a pulp writer." Not a novelist, but a pulp writer. And he had successes with Green Ice and other books and screenplays in the 30s. And I think that's such a wonderful thing to know that this is what you want to do.
The great mystery writer, Sarah Paresky, who's the previous guest on the show, has been quoted as saying, "Every time I start a new book, I get the feeling that I can't do this anymore, that I can't finish this book." But she always does. Many of her books show great research into some new area. Do you ever get that feeling that you're at the point and you can't get this done?
No, not yet. I remember one of my favorite quotes is, "You can correct a bad page, you can't correct a blank page."
I like that
one. Get something on there. Yes, those are the kind of quotes that ring in your head at 3 o'clock in the morning when you start boiling coffee in a sock and decide you're going to do another half page of something or other and get it on the page. And I admire writers who keep going. I look at the output of some people like Georges Simenon or very prolific writers who've been able to do things. And it's astonishing. George V. Higgins, as I mentioned to you, published more than 30 books in a period of about 30 years, in addition to teaching law and writing a newspaper column and prosecuting in the Watergate strike force. People who just have very full lives and also manage to turn out excellent series of books. I admire that. And I hope someday I'll be in that company.
McGee, have you ever interviewed Frank on the air?
No. But
we're not
going to
start tonight either.
Right, an interview. I mean, just when you talk to Frank, it feels like an interview. I mean, you're just question and answer. He's always got something interesting going on.
Frank, you have a continuing set of characters from previous books. Some writers have told me that that once they're into a book, the characters take over and determine the story. Others have told me that for them, they see the ending of the book before they start, and the writing is just how they get there. One writer that works in this fashion told me that it wasn't always 100% that he recently had the character that he had envisioned as the big character become so appealing that he wound up being the more fleshed out major character. Do you see the ending, or do your characters take you there? How do you handle it?
I see the ending before I start writing the first chapter. I work from an outline, and very often the more interesting characters do come to life. And if you know what's good for you, you'll go with them.
When I interviewed another great mystery writer, Mary Higgins Clark, years ago, she described her writing process as rising at 6 a.m. every morning, then writing until lunchtime. After lunch, if she had an appointment or the meeting, she went off. But if she didn't, she returned to writing. If not, she just started at 6 a.m. the next morning. Stephen King has the quote out there for years that he wrote 2,500 words a day. He later said that he really didn't mean it as a fixed number, just an indication that you must be on a schedule for writing. Do you put yourself on such a regimen?
Yes. I try to write every morning. The empty page that I'm looking at about each morning, it's like sunlight or the muddy brown coffee or the gold of the first egg that you eat. It's cheerful at that time of day because you don't know what's going to happen. The day holds promise, and hopefully your writing will too. And hopefully your writing is going to be cheerful, informative, and keep the reader turning that page. The mornings for me are the best.
Now, you return from your two-year European tour. Were you living at home again and with McGee and with your parents, or did you continue to come back there for a while from your various gigs?
I know. I got my apartment in the East Village very quickly, and I was working in the East Village and working to write the great American novel.
Frank, I don't remember you ever living back at home with your parents from maybe age 18 on.
For short periods, when they needed some medical help, I stayed with them for about a couple of years afterwards, but not when I was a teenager, no. It was very important for me to be on my own.
Yeah, no, he was the independent, the traveler, the writer, you know, the person who, where is Frank?
Where is Frank? This was pre-cell phone. So when it was pre-cell phone, you really didn't know where people were that much. You were dependent on
pre-cell phone, pre-computers. I remember there was the American Express office in Paris or some office that where we could send your mail and hope that you were getting it.
Right. That was the only mail drop I had in Europe for a long time. Because, of course, this is back in the 70s. They didn't have anything in terms of instant communication.
I mentioned Stephen King before. I think that his book on writing is the best one I've ever read. And I also really like Annie Lamott's Bird by Bird. Do you have any favorite books on writing, Frank?
George V. Higgins wrote a book entitled also On Writing.
Oh, okay.
And I found it funny and informative, as all of his stuff to my eyes. He was an uneven writer in a lot of ways. Unfortunately, he passed away too young. But On Writing, I thought was very good, and he would have lines in there about fiction versus nonfiction. He said, go for the nonfiction. It pays much better. lines that you're going to remember, things like that. And it was very much a, you don't know how to write until you know how to read. And you don't know how to read until you read aloud for a certain period of every day. And these are not popular ideas now, but he admired John O'Hara in terms of dialogue, and I think as much as one writer can, he inherited the mantle of very realistic dialogue to where you feel that you're in the same room with these people.
O'Hara
and Higgins could be casually brilliant that way.
O'Hara was terrific like that, and another guy who I don't think gets the credit, who I really liked growing up, maybe my taste would have changed by now, was James T. Farrell.
Right. Studs Lonergan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And many more than that. The Danny O'Neill series just went on and on and on. They followed this character. That was my favorite. You mentioned Higgins, my favorite mystery writer growing up, and I used to crack up some of his dialogue, was Leslie Charteris,
right.
The Saint book. I remember the same in New York. He's taking on some miscreant, and he tells him, "Do better cooperate, or I'll put you in the Gate of Heaven Cemetery in Valhalla, New York." And I think that has a ring to it. And that's where my grandparents are buried, and now my father. But I mean, this was the Brit who knew where the Gate of Heaven Cemetery in Valhalla, New York, was. And I thought that was terrific.
I think so, too. The Saint was very good stuff to read. Charteris wrote and published a lot in his lifetime and was prolific and always entertaining. He knew how to keep the story moving. He liked Simon Templar.
Yes, he did.
I must interrupt you two writers and sign off. It's time for me to go interview some of the warriors for the screening. I'm meeting these actors who starred in the film in 79, and they're, you know, screening it here on the boardwalk at Coney Island at 8. So tune in
McGee,
at 10 o'clock, Channel 11, if you want.
McGee, thank you very much for your participation. It's been wonderful.
Oh, it was fabulous listening to you both. I'm always so proud of my brother. Love you, Frank. See you soon, I hope.
Yes, you will. Thank you, McGee.
Korean Bye-bye. Food in Park Slope, I hope. Goodbye.
I hope.
We'll have you talk to the waiters. Bye-bye.
Yeah, Leslie Charteris wrote, I could not stand Roger Moore as Simon Templar. I just thought that was bad. We have another caller from the 845 area. Let me get this caller in. Caller from the 845 area, who are you?
Yes, Vin DiQuino.
Oh, and Frank, you're on Vinny's television show, if you remember.
Yes, I was. We had a wonderful time.
Hey, great to hear from here. I've been patiently listening. all these wonderful little insides with McGee.
Vin, you're taking notes for the next TV interview.
Right.
Material.
You know, I share your story about the finding the book in the trash can. You know, some of these writers come to me and they say, you know, I'm waiting for that right inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Say, ah, Frank Hickey found his in a garbage can.
That's right. It smelled pretty bad, the book, for a while, but I still venerated it. I kept it in the air as much as I could afterwards.
There's a great interview with Hedrick Smith, who I mentioned is my guest in 2 weeks. He has this video, and he's talking about being in places and some giving talks, and some fellow gets up and says, well, it was easy when we had people like Martin Luther King and all these people. They were leaders, and they could get out. And he said, wait a minute. He said, Martin Luther King was a minister that no one ever heard of. The only way that he became famous was he did something. And if you want something done, you do it. And he said, by the end of the talk, the guy had people around him, they were deciding what they were going to do in this town. And it's little things. Someone, if you find something like Frank, or someone says, how about you doing it, that gets people off their rear ends, I think, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think you're right.
And Frank, the other thing about you that, you know, I share with a lot of people is the fact that you write what you live. And it's so important because all those details that you add in your stories are so real. And so many people try to write the kind of book you write, without the background that you have, and they're missing the richness. You know, and I tell them to try to write what they know or at least what they love.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Especially what they love. What they
yes,
love.
Yes. And you certainly do love what you do and write.
I can remember wasting years of my life trying to be the kind of writer that was a classical writer that people would want to be seen reading. And someone like James Joyce or Thomas Mann or André Gide. And it took me years of wasted effort, I was writing, to find really where I belong, which is in crime fiction.
I was an English major, and I had to read all this stuff, and I have to admit that I hate William Faulkner. I could never get through one of his books, and I thought it was overrated and awful. And I finally reached the point that I stopped, or I tried to stop, I don't always do it, I tried to stop reading books that I should and read books that I want to.
Yeah.
And for instance, I'm reading the whole Light Mystery series now, and I normally do that. I'll see some author, and I'll run the table. And I'm up, I've just read the first four books in the Jan Ivanovich Stephanie Plum series, and they're just so funny. There was so much humor in it that I get a kick out of it. My wife's been listening to it on audiobooks, and she laughs out loud. So I said I better start, even though I had avoided her for years. Have you read any of her stuff, Frank?
Yes, I have, and I like it, especially the hand-to-mouth life of the private investigator. Because I became a private investigator very much as a kid apprentice before I knew how to drive a car.
Wow.
I'd never touched a handgun. I wore thick glasses. I had no idea what I was doing. I was copying Ross McDonald books as to how to be a private detective. That was my training, but I was taken under the wing of very experienced private eyes, most of them former policemen. And this was as if I were witnessing my own birth. And the street fascinated me, absolutely fascinated me.
The thing
well,
about Ross
in your books, and that's what I mean, you know, to write your fascination is what makes a book work.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And I love reading Lawrence Durrell and Thomas Mann and those classical writers, but I don't have their genius. I can't be them. And there's books, you want to be seen reading, and there's books you hurry home fast because you've got one in your pocket and you can't wait to get there and rip it open. And books are not dying.
Many
people
times,
say they are, but I don't know if either of you ride the New York City subways. Every subway car has three or four people reading a traditional book these days.
Wow.
You mentioned Ross McDonald. I'd read most of his stuff. He's a fine writer, but he had so many stories that ended with the guy who had moved back to town, who was now the something or other, turned out to be the missing son of someone that had died. He always had these people. You know, it was always like the Deus Ex Machina end. There was always some guy who, in the story, who turned out to be someone else. And after a while, that drove me crazy because I could pick out the guy, you know.
Right. Well, he published about 25 novels, say, between 1955 and 1970. So I tried to avoid ever falling into that trap. He himself, McDonald, had a very tough childhood growing up, and that's what painted his books in terms of the dysfunctional family, the runaway person, the missing heir. He was bounced between Southern California and Canada. Ross McDonald was not his real name. That was his pen name.
Right. It was,
and McLaughlin, McMillan, something. It wasn't even a Mac.
It was Milner. It was Milner, something like
Miller. Right, Miller.
And his wife was very prolific, whatever she did. Do you remember who she was?
No, I don't.
I was just reading about her him the other day, and his wife was either the writer or the singer, but she was extremely prolific. Vinny, we were talking before about writing, and Frank was saying that he has the regimen that he writes every morning. As you heard, he also carries notebooks around with him. He takes notes, and he has notebooks by his bed. How do you write? So what is your process?
Middle of the night, because no one's around, so I can't be bothered. Well, except by the cats who decide they want to sit on the keyboard while I'm trying to write. But I usually write in the middle of the night. I try to sleep a little bit and then use the quiet. I also like to read just before I start writing. And what it does is it either inspires me because of what I'm reading, or it inspires me to write in spite of what I'm reading. And what happens is, you know, I say, time to write. And so, you know, sometimes it's tough because I want to get back to bed. But once I get going and the engines get revved up, I'm able to move along and get those ideas going. I'm working on a brand new book now. I'm back, you know, in my paranormal state of mind. So I'm doing a new book on the paranormal. So the middle of the night is the perfect time to start thinking about ghosts and people who have been here before. So I'm actually working pretty hard now. Well, one of the things I do is I write in spurts. Once I'm in the middle of a book, I'm like up every night, and then I relax for a while and I don't do any writing for maybe a month or two, and then get back again. And you know, it's just my style. But you know, I talk to so many different other writers, and it's true. You know, there's so many different styles of writing. Some people write, you know, in the morning. Some people write in the backyard. Some people write in the attic. You know, I have my own little room over here with my little computer, and I shut the door, and that's when I enjoy writing most.
But I'm a columnist, and I write as I used to in the workplace. I always found that I operated best when there was pressure, when I was on deadline, and I write a lot like that. I had an interview. I guess it's a month ago. With Catherine Hiller on, and she's a writer who has written a bunch of novels that got very good reviews, including one that she was writing in the persona of Tom Sawyer's brother Sam, and it was very good. However, her most recent book I interviewed her on was Just Say Yes, and it's a real push for legalization of marijuana, which she openly uses. And in the book, she says that when she's ready to write, that she'll smoke the joint and then she'll start writing. And she says that she has this tremendous energy. And by the time that wears off, she's into the process and she's able to then go back and to edit anything that got way out of hand. So
wow,
I guess
interesting.
Yeah. And she's a Westchester person too.
Well, you know, one of the things, you know, I work with so many different writers, and you know, that's one of the things I say to them, that it's so important to understand your profile as a writer and to find out where, when, and how you write best. That sometimes just changing the time of day that you write, sometimes changing the seat or even the clothes that you wear, to actually change your clothes when it's time to write.
Are you supposed to wear clothes when you're writing? I didn't know that. Nobody told me.
See, that works even better when you don't.
I'm learning a lot on this broadcast. Thank you, John.
Yeah, so, you know, there's certain things, you know, people, you know, have styles, and I encourage writers to find who you are as a writer and what works best for you. Now, yep. Frank, you write all over the place, and,
yep.
You know, especially, note-taking. Now, you take a lot of notes when you're in the middle of a project, don't you?
Yes, and I'm thinking of ordering a bunny rabbit suit, size 44 long, if it will help me. Right? See if I could possibly get myself some publicity sitting on a flagpole that way.
That
everything
work.
Works. Exactly, everything
if
works.
If you haven't tried it, try it, Frank.
Exactly. I remember when I was struggling with my first straight novel, and as a joke, I told the agent, this is when Patty Hearst was still a fugitive, and Idi Amin was in the wind, still raining in Uganda, and CB radio was very popular. I told the agent as a joke, I'm writing a book called Breaker Breaker about a sex weekend between Patty Hearst and Big Daddy Idi Amin, told entirely in CB language.
And he paid
my
you
agent
in advance.
Said, right, my agent said, when can you finish it?
I used to ride the West Side Highway, and I would respond to, "Are you out there, Captain America? How about you, Captain America?" That was my handle. I was a big CBer. And the interesting, I wrote a column about this recently, was there was a whole bunch of people, number one, who were connected by this. There were people from New Jersey who came down to Palisades Interstate Parkway. And we used to meet at the Market Diner on 50th Street and 10th Avenue. And it was we actually had an antenna on the roof and a radio there until a guy got fired and stole a radio. But there'd be people calling in from the middle of the GW Bridge. You got the Eagle mid spam, bacon and eggs over easy. And by the time he got there, that'd be good. But the difference was, I mean, obviously, cell phones knocked that out. But you used to get reports from there's a down four-wheeler of 79th Street, get off at the 96. You used to hear this stuff. You don't know who to call on your CB to tell them something. So you really have lost that bit of community there that there used to be, even though the technology is better and they can get more stuff, but it's different. You know, every time that we have some new sea change in technology, it seems that we lose something.
Yeah, well,
you're right.
You know, the world has changed so amazingly. I mean, I watch people, you know, when you ask a question. Years ago, you know, you ran to the library to do your research. And now I watch these people, including my grandchildren, who just take out their little unit and they type in something and they have the answer. I mean, there's so much information
or they speak
at
to
fingertips.
It, which is eerie, or they speak the question into it, and they get an answer back.
Yeah, it is scary. I mean, there's just so much out there.
That was the question on the video that I showed to my students. How many hits there were on Google? How many questions there were in 2010 with something like 3 trillion or whatever? And what did people do BG before Google? You know, who do they ask these questions to?
They went to a bartender.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, or the barber.
Yes,
Frank, we didn't get into really your recent book announcement, and I missed your announcement party. I was teaching that night. What's the name of the book, and what can you tell us about it that will make the audience buy it?
The book is called When the Whistle Blows, Everyone Goes. Our hero Max is put in federal prison in California for a murder that he did not do. And Max being Max, he realizes that Bureau of Prisons spells BOP or BOP. And being a ballroom dancer, he organizes ballroom dances, swing dances, jitterbug bop dances between the inmates and gets everyone to speak in the 1940s dialect of hipsters. And calls the correctional officers, whom I respect greatly in the book and in life, calls them big boppers. So it's not easy to write a lighthearted book about prison.
No,
but
really.
I think Max was able to do it. Max was able to tell the story. And the killing took place in Palm Springs, a fascinating part of California that I know pretty well. And so far the reactions have been very good because there are not many books, not many crime novels written from the inside of prison.
Now, has it been released?
Oh, yes, it's out.
Oh,
it's
good.
It's been out now for a couple of months. I urge you to look it up.
Yes, I will.
It was a lot of fun to write, a lot of fun to read.
I saw Gandhi, Barbara and I saw Gandhi in the movie house in Palm Springs. We used to go out there to a regular conference, and it was interesting because it was a terrific place. But I understand that from May to early October, it's deserted because it's just uninhabitable with the heat.
Mm-hmm. That's when I was there. I like the heat. I lived in the desert. You may recall that Max has a book, Can Show Business Crush Crime, which is set in the Mojave Desert, where I lived for a year. And
wow.
The mayor of the town is one of my biggest fans out there. She bought one of the first editions of the book. And it's Max Goes West. Max is going west and living in the Mojave Desert in the heat. I find the countryside beautiful, the sunsets, the landscape, and fascinating. It's a part of America people don't think much about anymore. They just go to Vegas or Los Angeles and don't pay much attention to what's in between.
Where did you stay?
Where
did you stay in Palm Springs?
In Palm Springs, I stayed near the downtown area because I wanted to be able to walk without driving a car in Southern California. Try it when it's 105. It's not easy. And it was really a 10-minute walk to the main strip on Calle del Segundo, down the block from a Catholic church that Liberace had belonged to when he was living in Palm Springs. And it's an interesting mix of traditional desert, and they have a movie colony, their movie star colony. And I knew some of the people there, and I thought it would be an interesting place to put the latest Max Royster adventure when he gets out of prison eventually. Not wanting to spoil things, but he does do some work out there trying to clear himself.
We stayed at
Palm Springs was the place.
Two or three years in a row, this conference, it was a technology conference, we stayed at this terrific club. It was a pool and tennis club with the big conference center. And we got there early, and we had this sweeter rooms because we wanted to do some business on the ground floor. And what's his name? Jerry Cooney was training there for a fight.
Right.
And more people came, and Muhammad Ali came to see him training, and more people came to see Muhammad than they saw Cooney. But one morning, we're just out there, and we had been up late the night before. It's about 7:30, and I hear this screaming music out by the pool, and I jump up and run in the living room to throw the chaise to yell at this guy, and it's Cooney's sparring partner. He's about 6'5", whose muscles were bigger than my head, and I said, nice song.
It's a very nice song. I picked my apartment in Palm Springs to be near a restaurant hotel called Melvin's, which is an institution there. And finding out that Melvin was from Flatbush, as I am, and that he'd actually gone to the Erasmus Hall, which some of my family had gone to, and he's got pictures of the Brooklyn Dodgers all over the place, and they have live jazz music seven nights a week and ballroom dancing in the middle of the desert.
I didn't know about that place. It's
a Rat Pack hangout from Sinatra and the others back in the day, so that's where I was going to live, so I could walk to it and did. And wrote about it in my books.
The only thing that we really did downtown was that movie Gandhi. I remember seeing it there. But there was a friend of mine who was a managing partner of a brokerage firm. He happened to be out there at some tennis club, and we wound up going out to dinner with him and his wife. It's one of these weird things that you meet people in a very strange place. You know they're there. You arrange to meet them. There was a fellow who I used to stop at his house almost every week to have the computer repaired. He was in Phoenix when we were there, and he was at another hotel that we had dinner with, he and his wife. The only time in 30 years we ever had dinner with them. It's weird. You know,
serendipity.
You meet people in these strange places.
That's true.
Do you see yourself branching out from your present series to other novels or even to nonfiction? I mean, your whole life screams a memoir.
I think nonfiction has a place. I finished writing some nonfiction books, one in particular about the serial killer case I was on that I got into, again, way over my head. I didn't have the experience to be working the case. Nevertheless, I had it. Nonfiction interests me very much, but for the time being, I'm very challenged by putting out the next Max Royster mystery. And Max and I get along very well on the page and elsewhere, and I think that'll occupy me for the next few years.
Have you published the serial killer book?
No, that was never published. It was It was a pretty well-known killer. Three books already were out on it, and that kind of edged out some of the competition. But he was a fascinating person. He was a painter, a sketch artist. He only killed upscale women, and he did it across America and in Mexico, and probably did many more that were never attributed to him.
And why haven't you published it? Just because of the competitive books out there? Or does it need work? Or
excuse me?
Why haven't you published it? Is it because of the competitive books out there, or does it need more work, or what's the reason you're not pushing it out the door?
Well, the killer is dead now. He died in prison, and there may not be that much interest in it. And as I said, three other books have already been published about it. He killed a woman here in New York City, and it remained very mysterious about the others that were attributed to him or not. He was on the run for more than 20 years. And this was when serial killer science was not very well developed. So there's a lot we don't know about it. But for the time being, I'm very happy with the fiction world.
Yeah, that's the problem with nonfiction. You know, it's so hard to be sure all the facts are in line, and it's tough. It has to be as accurate as you can, and sometimes some of those facts are just not there.
True, very true.
I have a close friend who's a retired senior investigator for New York State Police, and he was the first computer crime cop in New York. And I've written about him. That was how I originally knew him. But he interviewed Joel Rifkin. But if you remember, he was the serial killer who happened to be stopped, but he had a dead woman in the back of his truck out in either Brooklyn or in Queens. He interviewed him, and I got to talk to him about that interview. He also he was also a funny story. He's a partial subject of a book on the crime about some woman who was killing her husband's out in Long Island. And he said he was in the office on the Sunday morning, and he said he had a hangover from a party night before. And he gets this call from a woman that she thinks that her mother has murdered her husband. So he agrees to meet her at the home. And they go into the house, and he said he was almost overcome by the smell. The woman, after she killed the husband, she had wrapped him up in air conditioning, what do you call it, insulation, and put him up in the attic. That was 6 months before. And there were three people living in the house. There was the mother, another daughter, and her husband who had just gotten out of prison and married the daughter. And it was a very interesting book. And the woman threatened to kill both the daughter who turned her in and John Delaney, my friend. You know, so it's an interesting case.
In certain households, you can get used to anything.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine walking into a house and finding people living in a place you can smell the dead?
I don't have to imagine it.
Why, have you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us.
It was an apartment building in Los Angeles, and the man had been behind. There was no air conditioning in the apartment. L.A. was in the middle of a heat wave, and the people on the floor knew something was wrong. It was in a bad neighborhood, high crime, inner city neighborhood, where I worked for most of my career in Los Angeles.
and they knew that something was wrong. Once you smell the body like that, servicemen and other people can tell you that. You never forget it. But they were not in a hurry to call us. And when we went in there, my partner and I, we weren't able to open windows because it's technically a crime scene. You don't know what had happened. You don't know if the death was natural or not. And it's horrific. You get scared because you take in another breath and you don't know what the next breath is going to be like. And the next breath that you take in is worse and worse and worse.
Was it a crime scene?
In your head.
Was it a crime scene, or did someone just die naturally?
Well, he was taking heroin. I found a heroin spike next to him. He was scantily clad, and his body had swollen up from the heat and from the natural causes after death. And we determined, the detectives determined later on, it was natural causes, but you don't know these things.
At the time.
You're the first person through the door. And I felt bad that night. I felt kind of blue. So I went out ballroom dancing. And my partner at the time was a 24-year-old female officer, very good, diligent officer from Minnesota. We nicknamed her the Minnesota Kitten. And she asked me, what did you do after that call? I said, I went out dancing. She said, that's why I don't go out dancing, Frank. You never know who you're dancing with. She said, I hope you took a shower before you went. I said, yes, of course. I took a shower before I went out dancing. She said, how could you do that after that? But I use ballroom dancing in police life, just like I do in the Max Royster books, to wash some of that blues away when you've gone through a thing like that.
Yep.
Because she and I were waiting for the medical examiner team for hours, as I said, unable to open a door or window, and to maintain the crime scene, and also we have to keep a visual on the body.
Wow.
And as I said, she was from Minnesota, and this was beyond her experience. Having lived a lot in New York and been on the subways a lot, it hardens you a lot more. But she was fresh from Minnesota.
Wow.
Vinny, speaking of strange things, I don't know whether you ever told Frank about that one woman from the Revolution that you were writing about, and then you found all different things around, and someone thought that her ghost was in his house or whatever.
Sybil Ludington.
Right. Have you ever told Frank that story?
Yes, he did. Yes. Very interesting story. I don't know if I'd have the courage to write these stories in the middle of the night in a country house. I really don't. I think for me, I would like to have a lot of noise around me and sunlight and a couple of chains on the door. I don't think I have the courage to get out of bed and write these things, living upstate where you do. I couldn't do that.
Yeah, you know, especially paranormal stories. Sometimes
exactly.
In the middle of the night, you know, you hear things and you wonder what you're exactly hearing.
I wrote a ghost story inside my first novel when I was a teenager, and I remember writing it and finishing it. I was in Barcelona, Spain, and I was afraid to go across the room after I finished writing it. And so after that, I made a vow I wasn't going to frighten myself by my writing anymore.
Yeah, I'm doing something new with this new novel I'm writing. It's the first time that I don't really know for sure how this book is going to end.
Mm-hmm.
I'm letting the character tell the story, and that is one of the strangest things I've ever done with a paranormal book, because it really does seem like the story is coming from somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
and someone else. And it does get very strange sometimes.
As I said before, you're a brave man.
We spoke of this earlier. We talked about people who know in the beginning, as Frank does, where the story is going. And I've talked to other authors who know generally, but when they get in the characters of the story, they may take it in a totally different direction. And some people, and Frank may have this too, because he keeps coming back to Max, have almost a communication with their characters. I remember a good friend of mine, my oldest friend, when he sold his only novel and did never really got out the door after, but he said when he left, he was so elated and he wanted to tell people. And the people he wanted to tell were his characters, But of course he couldn't, you know.
That's funny. That's funny. They're sitting on your armchair right there. They're moving around the room. They're adjusting the fireplace. They're ballroom dancing in my book.
Well,
they're there.
Yeah. Do you have that relationship? If you're walking down the street and you see something, does it become Max would like this or Max would get
yes.
a kick out of this or whatever?
Yes. And Max is not me. I was never in the NYPD. I was never thrown off any job for mental illness. Max is a drinker, a smoker, a divorcee. I'm none of those things. And he's a wise guy, a wise cracker. And he goes his own way. And he is not me. I have distance between Max, even though I'm very fond of him, and we've been through a lot of adventures together. But I do see things through his eyes a lot of times.
Yes. Now, Vinny's written books from the vantage point of a teenager. So obviously he's not a teenager, and one of his books, the one I'm most familiar with, is a teenager's reaction to the best friend dying, and how another friend seemed to be closer to this person when he thought he was the closest friend. And how do you get into those heads, Vinny? Is it from the years teaching?
Yeah, it's from the years teaching, and it's from just constantly observing other people and in their reactions. You know, I try to tell young writers that you don't always write about what is. You write about what if. And sometimes our experiences don't take us all the way that our characters can go. And our characters take what we have and run with it. And that's the part about writing that I love the most, is that it takes me to places where I could have gone but didn't.
Which kind of ties in with what Frank just said, that his character has many of the same experiences that he has, but has had also different experiences.
And
different. Okay. All right. This has been a terrific conversation.
Yeah, it has.
What's next for you, Frank?
We are working. I'm writing with the editorial We on Max Royster in Los Angeles, confronting the national issue of police brutality from what he sees on the street in one particular instance, and it spins off from that.
No, I've got three of your books. Are all the others up on Amazon? Can I get them
from
Amazon?
Yes. Feel free.
It's interesting, the vantage point on police brutality, if I can just tell a story. The night that Batman opened in New York, this years ago, we took my son to the opening show, and my son is now, he's the 41-year-old screenwriter living in St. Raphael, California, so it's a long time ago. And it was the 10 o'clock show, so we could have the show about 12, and I'm parked in a garage that puts your cars down to lower levels. So my car's just come up, and I'm paying the guy. My son's in the back seat. Then Barbara hasn't gotten in yet. And all of a sudden I hear whop. And there's some guy spread eagle across the front of my car in the windshield. And he's dressed nicely. He has a button-down blue shirt and clean chinos. And I said, okay, that's enough, off. So he gets off the car, and he starts chasing my wife around the car. So when she gets to me, I just get in the guy's way, and I say, stop, that's it. So then he starts, he says, and the dopey attendant says, is he a friend of yours? I said, no, he's not. So he starts with, you have to get in the car, and we have to go to the funeral. And now there's no way I'm going to get in the car and have this guy kicking on him. So I say, no, that's okay. Why don't you just forget it? And the guy tries to push me into the car. And he's a little guy.
Right.
And I, like, pick him up, and I throw him. And he must have gone 5-6 feet in the air. And my immediate reaction is, I don't have any trouble with this guy. All of a sudden, he comes off the floor, and his eyes are as big as an Iranian terrorist. And I said, oh, my God, it's going to go on all night. And he runs at me. And I grab him, and I I'm on a hill now, and I throw them again off to the side, but I fall. And all I can think of is I better get up before this guy does. And before I get up, there's a scruffy-looking guy out of nowhere who has this guy down, and he's smacking him with what looks like a radio, a portable radio. And I said, oh, my God, I don't know what's going on here. And my wife starts to scream, get in the car. She thinks they're all crazy. And the guy hollers to the guy, the cab parked out in front, and he hollers to the guy with the cab, get the other radio out of the car. They just broke it. And as I go to get in the car, the guy on top of the loony yells, stop, police. And he holds up a badge. So I say, oh, he's a cop. And he's very scruffy looking. George Bush, the original, was in town that day. And he was speaking both at UN, and he had something at the Waldorf. And it was the worst traffic they've ever seen in the city. Everything was clogged. These guys must have been there for that reason. And he won't let the guy up. And the guy's yelling and screaming. And all of a sudden, some woman, big woman in the white top and the brown thing, wearing a hat, she must have been from some emergency services, she comes along with a big needle, and they stick this guy, and they pick him up, and they put him in the truck. So the cop comes over to me and says, I just didn't want you driving out of here all upset because you might have hit pedestrians or going or whatever. So he gives me a piece of paper saying, if you have any big questions, and it's patrolman Hickey and Sergeant McMullen. So I'm driving home and I'm saying, gee, I should probably, I could be called as a witness if there's something going on with this guy. And they might have been looking at him because they came out of nowhere and they just started hitting him. But the friend of mine had just been thrown down on the tracks at the shuttle going from Grandstand to the IIT by some lunatic,
right.
and people held them up. People held them up, and they arrested the guy. And the guy, then he had to sign the complaints. And of course, it has his name and address, and he lives in Austin. And the guy made bail and skipped out. So he's actually wearing a disguise around, thinking that this guy now knows where he lives, you know? So, so I'm thinking, what do I do? And I called a friend of mine who's a cop buff. Then he said, you ought to send a letter to the chief detectives and pray to the guys who came to your aid. And I did. And I got the letter back where he named the first names of the cops. He actually looked into the incident. He said it's been put in the jackets of Patrolman Frank Hickey and Sergeant Sean McMullen. But and they all told me he probably went to Bellevue. He was the loony. If I had walked by and I had known this guy was a cop, and seeing him on top of some slight guy smacking him with this phone, I would have said police brutality. This is awful. Now, me being the person who was attacked, it was just the opposite. Hit him again. You know, don't let him up. You know, so
that's why it makes this such an interesting topic, and I think most writers want to stay away from it because it's controversial.
Yep.
It brings a lot of other things into play. Nobody ever has the same idea about it. It's much easier to sell the book about the murder in the country estate than it is to have one wrapped around the topic of police brutality. It's
right.
A sticky, guilt-ridden, conscience-ridden topic that the country is wrestling with now.
Well, there's the big thing going on now with James Blake, and Blake's been very upfront saying he doesn't think it had anything to do with his race, but this guy doesn't belong on the force, and apparently the guy had previous complaints, but that's in the headlines right now. And I think it was unusual before they had a hearing that both Mayor de Blasio, then your old boss, Frank, Bill Bratton, came out and apologized to Blake. What did you think of that?
Well, it sounds like somebody's trying to get me on this line. So okay. I'm going to have to leave you guys.
All right.
Okay.
But it's been
great talking
with you.
I'm glad you called in.
It was a pleasure, and hopefully I'll see both of you soon.
Yes, I hope so, too.
Well, keep writing and keep doing what you do well.
Be well.
Yep, you too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
What do you think of the Blade case, Frank?
It's a pending case, so it's still in flux. It would be premature for me to say anything right now. We have other cases safely in the past. And as I said, from a fiction writer's standpoint, it's a very tough topic because it's something that most people haven't really confronted until they've been victimized by it or know somebody who has. And it's very multifaceted. And
well,
nobody is happy with the outcome, most likely.
If you or I had been tackled in the street, we wouldn't have gotten an immediate apology from the mayor of the city of New York until he looked into the case. So don't you think that's
true? I'm not sure about that. When you're in public service, you have to realize when mistakes have been made, and you have to learn to be diplomatic and back water. You have to learn when you're wrong, you're wrong. And as I said, it's a pending case. I don't have the facts in that. But as a policeman, I remember apologizing to people on an hourly basis. And these were in very bad neighborhoods, very dangerous neighborhoods. And people understood that. And I would ask them very often, listen, sir, I got a radio call, armed robbery, this car, this make, this year, this color. And I saw your car come in front of me. What would you do if you were in my position? And when you took your time and you spoke to the folks like that, 99 times out of 100, you would get an understanding and a handshake and take care of yourself, officer.
Okay.
So this is also because I didn't become a policeman till I was – I didn't become a uniform cop till I was 37. So that is way old and maybe a different perspective. But we'll see what happens. It's a pending case, as I say. I'm looking at it now as a writer and not as a detective anymore. As a writer, it's fascinating.
If I'm correct, you've always spoken well of Bill Bratton. Am I right about that?
Yes, I think he's a great man. I think he's a genius. We see his handiwork in every neighborhood in New York City. And I saw it work in Los Angeles. His taking the job in Los Angeles when I was there was very much a part of physical survival and emotional survival. The department needed a man like him. The city needed a man like him, a person like him. And luckily we got him. The other choices were good, but he was, as I said, he is a genius at what he does.
I've always had great respect to both him and for Ray Kelly, who I've spoken to.
Kelly is a wonderful commissioner.
Yeah, he was the person who gave me my second diploma, my second master's at Marist, when it was in criminal justice. And I spent a good deal of time talking to him after it, and then I was at a party with him later at another time. And I'm sorry that they're on opposite sides of the stop and frisk issue, that they've kind of had at each other, and I think that's unfortunate. Yeah.
I think they're both consummate professionals and wonderful police chiefs, wonderful police commissioners. It doesn't have to be either or. I think they've both done amazingly good things for their cities.
We've touched a lot of bases tonight with good call-in. So what else would you like our audience to know about you?
I think we covered it. McGee surprised me very much by calling in. But as I said to you 10 minutes before we went on the air, nobody can control an Irish-American reporter. And she proved that by calling in unexpectedly. I certainly didn't expect that. That's more time than I have to talk to her most of the time because she works very hard. She works harder than any five people I know. So that was an unexpected pleasure.
I expected it.
And I still have so much to learn about writing. I mean, my goodness, there's still things that I'm learning how to do, trying to learn how to do. I just hope I live long enough to be the kind of writer that people will look up to all the time and rush to the bookstore, if they still have bookstores, or rush to the library or to the Internet to buy the books.
I expect her to call in if she had time. She said she was going to be on call, and she might not be able to. But but I was very happy. I think she added something to the show. I thought she was terrific. Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure, Frank.
Thank you, John. As always, it's a lot of fun.
A bit of commercial information. My column, as I mentioned earlier, appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, which is both a print and an online paper, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission Lee Hamilton and then critic John Simon. The Westchester Guardian is available at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmacrants.com. That's johnmacrants. Send any comments or questions on the show or any columns to me at johnmac13@gmail.com. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, and he's had plenty of them this year, thank the Lord, put it in a book. Go to my website, as I mentioned earlier, and tune in next week and all the weeks after, some very interesting guests. And until then, as I said in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, steady, Silver, steady. ¶¶